Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Poe, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled Away with Words, Part 3, Understanding Grammar for Powerful Communication. Your professor is Michael D.C. Drought. Professor Drought is the William and Elsie Prentice Professor of English at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts, where he chairs the English department and teaches courses in Old and Middle English, Medieval Literature, Chaucer, Fantasy, and Science Fiction. Professor Drought received his Ph.D. in Medieval Literature from Loyola University in 1997. He also holds M.A. degrees from Stanford in Journalism and the University of Missouri-Columbia in English Literature, and a B.A. from Carnegie Mellon. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin Away with Words, Part 3. Lecture 1, The Red Panda and the Drought Way. And now, Professor Drought.
When people find out I'm an English professor, the first thing that they ever say is, uh-oh, I better watch my grammar. Now, I think this is kind of ironic because I teach writing and I teach Old English, so I actually do teach my students grammar. But most college courses, most English teaching at the college level, doesn't actually teach grammar. So it's interesting that people immediately say, better watch my grammar. And in fact, most of those people who say, oh, you're an English professor, I gotta watch out, they actually have had college courses. So they've had college English. So they know that in college English, we often don't talk about grammar very much. And it's the first thing that people say. They never say, uh-oh, better watch my literary and rhetorical analysis, or uh-oh, better not get confused between dramatic and situational irony, or uh-oh, I don't want to mix up an Old English and Middle English now. And that last one actually really matters to me. But it always comes back to grammar. And this suggests to me that there's some real insecurity about grammar. When there are millions and millions of other things to worry about or to be insecure about, people always talk about their grammar. I mean, think about it. It's perfectly acceptable in most contexts that if someone starts to bring up numbers, math, ratios, and so forth, they can say, it was my understanding that there would be no math. And everybody laughs. We can discuss later if this is a good situation or not. But when it comes to grammar, people say, oh, well, I'm not very good at grammar. People, the most highly educated people I know, say I'm not very good at grammar. People simultaneously expect themselves to make errors and feel bad about it. Errors in grammar are just not what the right people do. And at a certain level, this is absolute nonsense. Because on the one hand, the average person jabbers out thousands and thousands of sentences per day, and millions of sentences per year, and the vast majority, we're talking vast out to two or three decimal places, are flawlessly grammatical. Linguists study these things. They've taped people, they've looked at recordings of people, and they find out that the vast majority of utterances that come out of people's mouths are grammatical. Even people who have bad grammar, because they have learned English as a second language, because they've grown up in a non-standard dialect, they are perfectly grammatical more than 95% of the time, unless they're really at a level of just learning English. You try to get a machine that can produce sentences that come even close to that, and no one can do it. So where is all the angst? Where does it come from? Why do people worry so much about their grammar? Well, there's a simple answer, and there's a complicated one. The simple answer is the whole, I'd better watch my grammar, is a different entity entirely. It's a different phenomenon than what linguists are thinking about when they talk about grammatical competence. Linguists are interested in the remarkable numbers of things that go right all the time. And regular people are much more interested in errors and in avoiding errors. So there's a completely different focus. People don't want to be 95% right. They want to be 100% right. And errors stand out the same way that the one car accident on the side of the road stands out as opposed to the thousands of cars driving past fine with no problem. But that's an oversimplification. the more complex answer to the question, why do people say, I better watch my grammar? Why do they worry about grammar? Why do they have so much angst about grammar? Is that when people say, I'd better watch my grammar, they're not looking at grammatical competence. They're looking at their social relationships. People are interested in the subtleties of grammar because those things mark us out as belonging to particular social groups, educated, not educated, from here, not from here, all of these different situations and separations between people. And they don't want to be on the wrong side of any of these sociocultural barriers. Now, I'm a partially trained linguist. I'm a fully trained scholar of language. So if I split an infinitive, who cares? I have the highest possible rank in terms of education about grammar. So in most situations, I'm just not worried whether or not my speech marks me out as someone who doesn't belong there, or someone in the wrong social situation, or someone who doesn't deserve to be in this position. I just don't worry about it. Now, I will say, on the other hand, I've never been invited for dinner with the kind of people with really old, old money who endow whole universities. So maybe if I were in that situation, I'd worry about my infinitives or something like that. But I have the benefit of being able to invoke the English professor rule. If I said it, it's grammatically correct enough for me. And so it ought to be grammatically correct enough for you. That's very bogus, by the way. That's misuse of authority. But I can get away with that because I'm an English professor. But for most people, for normal people, for the kind of people who don't read the Reverend Walter Skeet's Principles of English Etymology from cover to cover, I've done that. But for normal people, mastering certain arcane rules of grammar and having enough time and concentration to follow those rules of grammar is a way of separating people from each other. Based on some tiny, tiny subset of usage, whether you put a preposition at the end of a sentence, whether you split an infinitive, whether you dangle a participle, for example, and those aren't actually as important as people think, you can tell who is educated and who's not, even though this isn't entirely true. Now, of course, the use of particular grammar cues is only slightly correlated with actual education and is not at all correlated with intelligence, but people still care about it exactly because it has that social weighting and that cultural effect. Now, I try not to, I think I often succeed, in not worrying about my grammar, but I have the advantage of studying language for a living. And it's not like the same sorts of things don't affect me either, and they're just not related to grammar. For example, if you put me at a fancy dinner party where I'm not allowed to pick up the food with my fingers or wipe my mouth on the tablecloth, all of a sudden, I am worried about certain arbitrary customs, and I have to think, okay, I better watch my manners, I better not dig things out of my teeth with the edge of a business card, and so forth. Humans are exquisitely sensitive about these markers of social rank. And so language is only one of these markers. And so when people say to me, Professor Drought, you're an English professor, I better watch my grammar, they're really doing the same thing that I do when I show up at a dinner party and I just happen to mention, you know, I grew up in suburban New Jersey eating Cheese Whiz sandwiches and Dinty Moore beef stew out of a can, so I don't know which fork goes with which particular course. In that situation, besides trying to get a laugh, I'm saying, I know there are rules about this stuff, and I want to show you respect, but I don't actually know what the rules are, so please don't think poorly of me if I don't follow them. And that's exactly what people say when they say, oh, you're an English professor, I better watch my grammar. Unfortunately for me, my idea of saying I'm from suburban New Jersey, you shouldn't pay attention, doesn't work with my wife or with other people. But the trick of saying, you're an English professor, I don't expect to bring my grammar up to your level, does work with me and with many other people. And so if I translate that phrase, it actually means, I know that you, Professor Drought, English professor that you are, might spot deviations from some arbitrary standard in a few aspects of my grammar. That grammar won't be precisely perfect, because I haven't studied it as much as you. So by saying, I better watch my grammar, I am preventing you from going, gotcha, when I don't obey all the confusing and complicated social customs surrounding grammar. Amazing I could get that from so few words, huh? That's what English professors do. We interpret, so we can make things up sometimes. But so what do we do? On the one hand, we're concerned about our grammar. And on the other hand, how do we improve or change it or make it so that we're on the side of the social boundaries that we want to be on, The same way that I guess I could actually bother to go out and learn which particular forks to lift and what manners to have and stuff, and I probably should at some point. Well, there are a couple approaches. And the first of those, I think, is exemplified by a book by Lynn Truss. It was a New York Times bestseller called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, The Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation. In this hysterically funny book, and yeah, really, there's a hysterically funny book about punctuation, Truss proudly defends grammatical sticklers, that is, people who will correct your spin infinitives, dangling participles, and most of all for Truss, your misplaced apostrophes. Truss thinks that traditional correct grammar and pronunciation are something worth preserving, and we should strive to follow whatever correct usage is, and we should learn what it is. Okay, so that's one side. And the other side is exemplified by David Crystal, who has a book called The Fight for English, How the Language Pundits Ate, Shot, and Left. And you can tell that this is a reaction to Truss, obviously, since she took her title. Now, Crystal is an immensely distinguished scholar of linguistics at Oxford, and he sees the sticklers, the people who would correct your grammar in public, the people who would mark off on your memo if you had a split infinitive or if you had a subject-verb agreement problem or something like that. He sees those people as bad, even though he agrees that Lynn Truss is very funny. But he sees those people as bad because they're maintaining class and social boundaries, they're penalizing people from different social or cultural backgrounds, and they're trying to reinscribe, to use his words, all kinds of social, class, and race attitudes that he doesn't like. And here's the problem, is that Truss and Crystal are talking right past each other, even though they acknowledge each other, they're just completely missing the point of the other one. Crystal goes out of his way to say, oh, I'm not an anything goes kind of guy, though he doesn't really actually give any guidance as to how you should affect or change your grammar or what's bad. And Truss, on the other hand, even though she's like relentlessly mocking things like the use of apostrophe to mark the simple plural or the lack of an apostrophe where it belongs, she actually talks about wanting to walk around with an apostrophe on a stick and go up and hold it up to signs that are missing the apostrophe. But she says she has sympathy for people who find that simple S with no apostrophe on words ending with a vowel looks odd sometimes. And she's right. But again, neither one is really engaging with the other arguments. And even worse, neither one of them gives a sensible approach to changing your own grammar, which is, I assume, the reason that you're listening to this course. Crystal's point that we should accept like a wide variety of usages as grammatical is really nice in some kind of existential way. Like, we should be more tolerant, we should be more caring, we should not judge people based on their grammar. And that's great, and I would love to live in that kind of a world, but that's not the kind of world we actually do live in. So if you go and tell people, you know what, from a linguistic point of view, your grammar's flawless, that makes them feel good for like 2 seconds, and then they still say, Professor Drought, you're an English professor, how do I improve my grammar? So you can tell people all they want, they don't need to change it, but they want to. And we're not going to change the entire world, so let's change people's individual grammar if they want to. I kind of take Crystal as like the personal trainer at the gym where I go. If the personal trainer said to me, you know, Mike, you should just be happy with your current body shape, not get so worked up about trying to lift weights and change the way you look. I mean, you're not grotesquely overweight or incredibly weak, so it's just basically average, it's fine. I would probably go find another personal trainer. And I think the same thing for a grammar teacher who says, yeah, you're basically good, you're fine, move along, don't judge people, you're all set. Now, unfortunately, Lynn Truss, as funny as she isn't particularly helpful. She gives you many, many, many rules for punctuation. She even gets into some of the history behind it, and most of the time she gets it right, but her rules don't really hang together in anything that you can pick up and learn from her book. You just get a lot of good laughs, and I highly recommend the book. My students always love reading it, but they come away with it the way they came away from my 8th grade grammar class. They've got a lot of partially understood rules and a lot of confusion. And so I bring you the Drought way. I'm offering, instead of Truss's stickler approach or Crystal's almost anything goes and just try to be more open-minded approach, something that I think is far more reasonable and effective. I kind of would, wouldn't I? The Drought way. It's a middle ground between let's celebrate grammatical differences and trust is zero tolerance. On the one hand, Crystal is right. It's an obnoxious power play to, say, correct someone's split infinitive. See, I'm an English professor, so I just split that infinitive and nothing happened to me. But it's really obnoxious to do it and show social superiority. Oh, did you just split an infinitive? On the other hand, you know, life is what it is. Enough people are prejudiced against non-standard grammar that it's worth developing your own grammatical knowledge so that you can switch back and forth between standard and non-standard, between formal and informal, the same way that we do in all kinds of other social situations. And also, then when you run up against these people, these sticklers who really don't know what they're talking about, you can follow the convention, but also you can know what you're talking about and even defend yourself. My analogy is this. In my heart of hearts, I really think elaborate table manners are stupid. I'm sorry, I do. My excuse is that I'm from New Jersey, which isn't fair because other members of my family have lovely table manners. But I really just, deep down inside, don't care which fork I use. There's no existential sorriness in my heart if I pick up the lobster fork and use it on some other type of food. But I recognize that I might want to avoid embarrassing my wife or embarrassing myself or undercutting what I'm trying to accomplish by being at the dinner party in the first place. So I learn some rules. I figure out how, in my wife's words, not to eat like a barbarian. And I even discover that there's a small bit of intellectual elegance in the relationship between the different dining implements and the different kinds of food. I mean, did you realize that they actually are made so that like one fits whatever you're trying to eat? I hadn't really realized that. So the drought way is this. You learn about the details of grammar. You pick up the, quote, good grammar, because it's something incredibly interesting anyway, because it relates to other human beings. And let's face it, other human beings are interesting. They're the most interesting things in the world. But also, you still know deep down inside, this is the other part of the drought way, you know deep down inside that a grammar error just means that you picked up the wrong fork. It has nothing to do with your intelligence. It has nothing to do with your basic broad-ranging education. And it has nothing to do with whether you're a good person or not. It's simply a custom that you haven't entirely mastered, like a dance step or a new piece of technology. That's all it is. Siphon away all the stress and then learn about grammar for the sheer joy of it. I actually wanted to entitle this course The Joy of Grammar, and maybe we will at some point. Really, learning about grammar is a wonderful, joyful experience. It's a great feeling to understand all of a sudden why the rules are the way they are, to see how modern grammar, the kind that linguists do, explains those arbitrary rules, and to show how that a lot of things in our grammar are there due to history. And that is the second part of the drought way. We don't go the whole hog on what could be called modern grammar or transformational generative grammar and talk about X-bar syntax and WH movement and identifying things as D structure and S structure and NPs and VPs. And we'll actually explain all that in a later lecture. But we don't ignore all the old school rules and terminology either, because that's what people know. What we do is we use the modern transformational generative grammar to explain the old school rules. Now, the drought way has a mascot. I represent the drought way with the red panda. And I've asked my publishers here to sneak a red panda onto the cover of this course. I don't know if they're going to do it or not. But in any event, the red panda is our course mascot. And I have my daughter's Beanie Baby Panda sitting here in the booth with me right now. Let me explain why the red panda is our totem animal for the rest of this course. Well, bizarrely, regular old black and white pandas, Aluropoda melanoleuca, for those who want the scientific name, which means black and white catfoot, actually, have become the mascots of grammar books. And it all goes back to Lynn Truss's book about punctuation. She starts out with this joke. A panda walks into a cafe. He orders a sandwich, eats it, then draws a gun and fires two shots in the air. Why? Asks the confused waiter as the panda makes toward the exit. The panda produces a badly punctuated wildlife manual and tosses it over his shoulder. I'm a panda, he says at the door. Look it up. So the waiter turns to the relevant entry in the wildlife manual, and sure enough, he finds an explanation. Panda, large black and white bear-like mammal, native to China. Eats, shoots, and leaves. I'll be a pedantic professor and explain the joke just to really suck all the life out of it. The panda interpreted eats, shoots, and leaves as eats, then shoots, and then leaves, instead of eats, shoots, and leaves, like bamboo shoots. Yeah, really took the life out of that joke entirely now, and you'll never want to hear it again. But the point is that punctuation matters, right? Because you've given the panda an excuse to run around shooting things. Well, let's leave aside walking, talking, eating in cafes, and so forth. Now, David Crystal's book also has a panda on the cover, though he doesn't have a good panda joke. He just thinks that the critics of English grammar usage, he would never use this, he's too politically correct, but I would call them grammar Nazis. He would say they just ate, shot, and left. Yeah, I couldn't get a laugh out of that either. But for whatever reason, now the panda is the official mascot of grammar books. Truss uses it one way, Crystal's trying to reappropriate the panda. Well, since I am reasonable, and Truss and Crystal are not, though they're both really nice people as far as I can tell, and actually almost everyone who loves grammar turns out to be a nice person. It's a weird thing, as opposed to being kind of a jerk and pointing out things. People who study grammar for a living turn out to be really relaxed about it. But I'm not going to lower myself to engage in panda squabbling. They can keep their ordinary black and white pandas, because I will use the red panda. Here's why. A long time ago, back when I graduated from college in 1990, I went on a trip to the Bronx Zoo with my best friend from college. She's now the Broadway actress Christiana Knoll, but she was just my best friend then. We saw a sign at the Bronx Zoo for the new Himalayan part of the zoo, and it said, "New Red Panda." Well, Christy was really, really excited to see this red panda. She said, "We have to see the red panda. We have to go." I'm like, "Oh, okay." So we had to go on this little monorail that takes you to the Himalaya section, and you can see like a yak and I think snow leopards and other things. So we ended up sitting in the monorail right behind the woman with the microphone who tells people what animals are outside and gives them a little spiel. So we're sitting right up next to this woman. And the monorail comes around a corner. And there, curled up on a tree branch, is the red panda. The tour guide says, "Now if you look to your left, you can see the red panda sleeping in the sun." And so Christy looks to her left, and she sees the red panda sleeping in the sun, and she bursts out, "That's no panda, that's a f***ing raccoon!" This was loud enough for the entire train to hear. And the woman with the microphone practically collapsed into laughter. Because Christy thought we were going to see a panda, like a big black and white bear, that had some kind of special redness about it. A red, pause, panda. But instead, what we were seeing was an entirely different animal that she didn't know about, which is possibly related to the panda, and that is the red panda, Ailurus fulgens, which means shining cat in Latin. And the red panda really does look like a bleeping raccoon. It may even be related to the raccoons. It's a little furry thing with a long tail and kind of a mask on its face. And it looks nothing like a big black and white panda, or even, I guess more exciting, a big black and white panda that was red. So that's where that punchline, "That's no panda, that's a bleeping raccoon," came from. Well, I want you to interpret Christie's punchline in a different way. When Lynn Truss says, essentially, grammar's all about being a stickler and learning the rules and sticking to them. And when David Crystal says, it should really be descriptive grammar, and we should learn to be more accepting and we'll let important committees of experts decide for us what right or wrong, I want you to say, "That's no panda, that's a bleeping raccoon." We're not going to take either side. Instead, we're going to take what's good from each side and reject what's stupid from each side, and build our own better approach. And that approach is the drought way. Now, after I prepared this lecture, I discovered what could be another punchline to the joke. Recent research suggests that the red panda isn't actually a bleeping raccoon, but it's actually a bleeping skunk. I'm not making this up. Phylogenetic analysis suggests that the giant black and white panda is related to bears. Okay, there's a real shocker. It kind of looks like a bear. But that the red panda may actually be the skunk or in the skunk in the weasel family. I now kind of wish I didn't know that because it makes it look like my joke will backfire on me. But I'm just going to try to ignore the fact that the red panda might be a skunk. I'm going to think of it still as a different kind of panda. And I'm pretty sure that this course is not going to be a skunk either, but instead will be a red panda in the best sense of the idea. Because instead of fighting over who really owns the black and white panda, as Truss and Crystal do, we're instead going to find the sensible middle ground. We're going to figure out why English grammar works the way it does, why the rules are what they are, And then we'll decide which rules to follow and when. And then if you ever get into an argument about grammar with someone, and they are telling you that you're wrong because you haven't learned anything, or they're criticizing your split infinitives, you can always just at least confuse them completely by saying, "Well, that's no panda, that's a bleeping raccoon." So here's how we're going to work through the course then. We've set up the red panda and the drought way. And in our next lecture, we're going to talk about what grammar is. And by that, I mean what linguists think grammar is, and what cognitive psychologists think grammar is, and what English teachers think grammar is. So we're going to work through kind of a definitional explanation of where grammar comes from. And then we're going to move on to why it is the way it is, how English got this way, whatever way this way is. How did English become this grammatical creation, this very complex grammatical creation? What's the history behind English? And then we're going to talk about spelling. You don't think spelling is going to be interesting, but I promise you spelling is going to be very interesting, because we're going to explain why G-H-O-T-I could conceivably spell fish. So we'll work through the kind of history of the English spelling system and why English spelling is a mess. And I'm a big lover of English. Obviously, I study it for a living. I will apologize for or even justify English grammar, but there is no apologies for English spelling. It's a mess. But we're going to figure out how it's a mess and how to work through it. That's then going to set us up for talking about what are called word classes. And these are the different kinds of words that you have. You might remember this from school as nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs and so forth. So we'll work through all the different word classes. And after we finish and have mastered all the different word classes, then we're going to move on to talking about pronouns in the noun system. I know that doesn't sound immediately exciting, but it turns out that pronouns are some of the most grammatically and cognitively complicated things in English, which is why children, my son and daughter included, had so much trouble learning pronouns. So we'll spend some time explaining how the pronoun and noun system works, and then we will have three whole lectures on the verb system. And that's actually really compressing it. The English verb system is complicated, and most of, or maybe I'll say the great majority of the things that people worry about in English are related to the verb system. So first we're going to just talk about good old regular verbs and the problems they create. But then we're going to get where we get our infinitive split, our participles dangled, our modals, and other weird things with verbs. And those are the verbals. And then finally, we'll get to the highly irregular verbs in English. And this is an area in grammar studies where people really have a lot of concerns, and I'll be able to give you some simple rules to clear those concerns up. With all of those things in place, the parts of speech, the pronoun and noun system, the verb systems in place, it will then make sense to talk about subjects and predicates and objects. Oh my! Now we'll talk about subjects and predicates, which is old school and old fashioned. We'll talk about the more modern way of describing them in terms of noun phrases and verb phrases, and we'll see why things like who and whom or he and him become a problem and how to solve them. Then, for lecture 11, we actually do move into what's called modern or contemporary or post-Chomskyan grammar. And this is a section on transformations. It's the most complicated thing in linguistics right now. But when we understand how transformations work, we're going to see exactly where some of the problems in English grammar come from and how to easily solve them. And that brings us to the kind of three concluding chapters for the course. Phrases and clauses are the reasons for pauses. That's my little rhyming title for chapter 12. But we'll talk about how sentences are broken up into phrases and clauses, because that explains then the mysteries of punctuation, where you put commas, where you put semicolons, where you put colons. It's all about phrases and clauses. And that's what we'll also do in lecture 13, which is go through the mysteries of punctuation. And finally, we'll talk about the fight for English. Yeah, for English, not for England. That's how David Crystal entitles his book. Well, he just entitles it The Fight for English. But we're going to conclude by talking about why there is a fight for English, what that fight means, and how to make sure that either your side wins or you're on the winning side of that fight. In the end, you're going to come out of this course knowing more about grammar than 99% of the educated people in the world. And I mean that seriously. Most people, even those who are very confident in their grammar, in their formal grammar, in their formal style, in their writing, in their speaking, don't really know why they do what they do. When you're done with this course, you will know why you do what you do. You will know why we put these words together in the way that we do and why we have some rules, and then you'll be able to decide when to follow the rules and when to break them. So I'm very excited to be moving along and to teaching grammar, and that's what we're going to start in the next lecture by defining what we even mean by what is grammar.
This ends Lecture 1.